Mapping Project is a vision which encapsulates new work, the commissioning of writers, poets, choreographers, composers, filmmakers, video makers and photographers.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Pass Forward, the Wapping Project 20. My name is Gareth Evans and for this episode I'm delighted to be in conversation with the award-winning writer Kapka Kasavaba. Welcome to you, Kapka.
Hello, Gareth. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
And to you, Kapka. It's really great to welcome you from the Highlands of Scotland for a conversation about your wonderful piece of writing, To Step Across the Line, which gave its title to the publication in which it was published, one of the Wapping Project commissions. Now, this is a text that engages with your ongoing investigation, of course, across a number of books now, into the idea of borders, of thresholds, a sense of place writing that engages, of course, with history, with culture, with politics, with the movement of peoples and the movement of ideas. Now, in your book Border, of course, this is taken to book length form and really engages deeply and has been provided really one of the key texts of our times for thinking about this, of course, extremely relevant and ongoing theme. But for this text, you took a slightly different approach and you used the childhood game of hopscotch as a way of thinking structurally and strategically about your theme. Can you recall for us how that idea came about and just take us a little bit into the writing, if you could?
Yeah, To Step Across the Line is something that came to me as a kind of image from an encounter with a woman on the Bulgarian-Turkish border who is an ethnic Turk originally from Bulgaria, and in her childhood she had been part of a huge kind of exodus of, you know, there had been an episode in the 80s of forced migration. And 300,000 Bulgarian Turks were forced to move to Turkey, and she had been a child then. And she had sort of been moving, you know, across that border all her life, first traumatically and then by choice to visit relatives back in Bulgaria. And she said to me, you know, the only good thing about a border is that you can cross it. And then I thought of lines in the sand and lines drawn with chalk, which of course a lot of us, you know, my generation of kids remember. I don't know if kids play anymore in the same sort of free way, you know, unsupervised. But you know, drawing, you know, a shape with chalk, and then. Crossing the line, as in hopscotch, there's something really infantile about these, infantile both in the good sense, childish and playful, and in the kind of, I suppose, unstable sense that borders are really lines in the sand. They are arbitrary. The arbitrariness, often cruel arbitrariness of borders, is something that has preoccupied me since childhood, because I grew up behind the Iron Curtain, you know, a very arbitrary and deadly border, which lasted for almost half a century and affected half of Europe. So really my, you know, my instinctive approach to talking about borders always has to start with that, with my personal connection, my personal investment in the subject of borders, which begins, you know, in early life for me, the shadow of the border.
Exactly. Thank you very much indeed for that. Now, as you said, of course, at the beginning, the idea of a border is, you know, is incredibly ambiguous and, of course, can save your life as well as, of course, take your life, depending on which side of it you're on, depending on the events unfolding in question. Now, in the piece, you travel across a number of borders. You obviously look at the Balkans, where you are, of course, very familiar with, and you think about the Highlands. You move to Thailand towards the end of the piece, and you pass also across to Turkey from Greece as well. So we you know, in just a handful of pages, we're travelling internationally, and the borders identity changes, you know, in those encounters. Of course, it's both something that's universal, it's internationally understood, but also does have a very particular local sort of inflection, I guess, partly depending on where you are physically, but also where you are in the history of the location. What is your sense really of changing aspect of borders, as opposed to in a different way, what is shared between them? Borders can be very different, can't they, I guess, depending on where you are and how history is unfolding for you.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the fascination of borders, really, for me, that they are supposed to be, you know, borders are meant to be fixed binary lines, you know, here and there, us and them, you know, simply stepping across the line. There is a kind of intended fixedness and simplicity to borders, and yet they are some of the most dynamic places on Earth. And a border that was previously a place of trauma, say the Bulgarian-Turkish border, which is perhaps the most evocative border for me. You know, in the 80s, it was a place of great trauma when 300,000 people crossed it by car, by foot, you know, on an unwanted exodus. And, you know, that border for me still holds that trauma. But at the moment, and for the last, you know, 30 years, it has been simply Europe's busiest commercial border, because lorries from Asia cross into Europe through that checkpoint. And it's a very colourful place. You know, it's an opportunity to watch the exact sort of, the most porous place, if you like, for trade and traffic, legal and illegal, between Asia and Europe. It's like what the Bosphorus used to symbolize. Now that's the Bulgarian-Turkish checkpoint. So borders can be like that, you know, sleepy at one point, hugely traumatic at the next sort of historical point of activation, and then, you know, simply places of exchange, places that you can, where you can step across the line in a more playful, you know, sort of discovery driven way, because borders are also, you know, these porous kind of points of contact and mutual fascination. And at their best, you know, if we have to have a world with borders, at their best, that's how we should be experiencing them.
Exactly. Thank you very much indeed. Now, I mean, the essay you've written for the Wapping Project is incredibly rich. I mean, there's all sorts of ideas and many, many different directions we could take this conversation in. We are going to hear it read fully very shortly. But just to draw listeners' attention really to a couple of key points, and I'd just like to read this sentence from your piece, Kapka. This border is hell for the refugee and heaven for the entrepreneur and the corrupt official, the smuggler and the storyteller. Now, I really like the fact that you put the storyteller in there, although there's someone who benefits perhaps from a series of other negative encounters, because you're obviously implicating yourself in that. The idea that there are very rich, rewarding, fascinating, complex human stories to be gathered at a border is, of course, you know, central to how, you know, your own writing has progressed around these landscapes. And you know, that's obviously, you know, a key element of what you find when you travel. As a woman traveling in these areas, which are often, you know, unstable for all the reasons that we've talked about and many more, do you find that identity gives you a sense of a particular response from the people that you meet? Do you feel more vulnerable or in some strange way, perhaps less vulnerable at a border?
That's such an interesting point, actually. And it is part of the narrative in Border, the book, in a small way. Because, yes, being a woman in what is essentially, you know, borderlands are very male places, literally, because the border patrols are always men. Also, a lot of the entrepreneurs and people who are active locally, especially the shadier characters, are men. But also a male place because of its binary intent. There is something very sort of... the paradox of a border is that it's meant to be this kind of aggressive line in the sand, but the reality is, and therein lies the paradox, is that it's a hugely porous, dynamic, and shape-shifting place. So being a woman in a space like that is actually an advantage. If you know, once you overcome the sort of the primitive fear of it, because yes. These are also often places which preserve. That's another paradox of borderlands, which preserve wilderness, precisely because of their remoteness and their deliberate political isolation. They can also be places of preserved precious wilderness. So there is this constant sort of negotiation, really, this constant dance, you know, for me as a woman, as a lone woman there, as a solo woman, between kind of courting the danger implicit in story hunting, and the advantage of not being seen as a threatening presence. That is a great advantage for the story hunter, that people feel that you are a safe presence, and that also as a woman that you can hold their heavy stories for them.
That's really interesting. Thank you. That's a tremendous response. And I mean, just really to follow up on what you said there about the idea of the remoteness, a kind of, you know, a natural wilderness, perhaps, and also maybe a human one as well. We can't help but be aware, of course, of borders at this time. We're recording this conversation as the UK comes out of its winter lockdown in March. And of course, a virus knows no borders. It travels wherever it wants to. And at the same time, we are being redefined here in the UK by borders ever more heavily as time goes on, of course, because of Brexit and the huge problems that come in its wake. So, you know, your project is, of course, ever more relevant and will remain so, of course, for the foreseeable future. But I just wonder if we could also think a little bit about your own really wonderful place writing, because as well as your, you know, extremely engaged meeting with people and their histories, of course, in these landscapes, you're also extremely evocative in the sense of place that you conjure for us. And I just wonder if you've come across borders that are good borders in a way. I don't mean in a human sense, but borders that actually, you know, in some cases obviously do follow landscapes and become, you know, ecological borders. They make sense. They you know, either, you know, lie along the line of mountain ranges, or they understand a relationship to water, etc. You know, that sense of place where a border not makes sense perhaps, but at least feels less intrusive than it might do otherwise. Are there locations like that for you?
Yes, certainly. I think those are really the natural borders, you know, the natural sort of parameters of all territories defined in one way or another. If we look at Europe as a, you know, in terms of land mass and relief, then we will find that. So, for instance, the Bulgarian-Turkish border is to this day a river which empties into the Black Sea. That is a kind of harmonious border in geographical terms. Another interesting border, I don't know, that's not necessarily a positive example, but it's an example of an invisible border, a purely mental construct of a border. And that's the triple national border on the lakes Ohrid and Prespa, which are the protagonists of my new book, To the Lake. You know, these two lakes are shared by three countries, and obviously they're massive lakes, the oldest in Europe. The border is invisible, but it is in people's heads to this day. And, you know, boatmen don't cross it, even though you can't see it, they see it in their heads. So it's a perfect example of how we project the contents of our psyches individually and collectively onto the land. And these lakes are, of course, a perfect ecosystem. They are connected by underground rivers, invisible to the eye. You know, on the surface, they are divided by a mountain. And as bodies of water, they are complete. And as ecosystems, they are complete. But in people's heads, because of the political damage of the Cold War, which is kind of slowly fading, you know, there is this incredible projection onto the water where, you know, you go out with a boatman and you say, why can't we just go across over there to the Albanian fish restaurant, which is playing, you know, this Italian music? go and have fish and then come back to Macedonia. You know, it's within swimmable distance. And he says, it's because the border, you know, is sort of 50 meters from here. And of course, you can't see anything, but he can. And that's, I think, worth sort of keeping as a kind of metaphor of how we torment ourselves, really, when the land, you know, when the landscape presents us with a perfect possibility of how life could be.
That is really tremendous. Thank you so much. Well, I think if any of our listeners have not read Kapka's books, there is absolutely no excuse now for you not to go immediately to your independent bookseller of choice, of course, and find all her titles. This is really wonderful textured writing, as you no doubt will understand now, having heard Kapka's wonderful responses, which engages both with the deeply metaphorical nature of borders and the landscapes they pass through, as well as, of course, with the actuality of lives and histories. So please do find Kapka's books wherever you would choose to buy your volumes. Thank you so much indeed, Kapka. We're now going to actually hear your essay, or your wonderful piece of writing for the Wapping Project, read for us by the award-winning actor Leah Williams.
Thank you, Gareth.
There is something about borderlines that attracts and repels at once. As soon as a line is drawn in the sand, a desire arises to step across it. Like the need to tell stories, the need to step across the line may be hardwired in our brains. The favourite neighbourhood game of my childhood was hopscotch. All you needed was a piece of chalk. You drew a few lines on the asphalt and you created a microcosm of meaningful boundaries. You jumped in and out, and the winner was she who didn't stumble and lose her balance. All my life, I have had a hyper-awareness of borders. I grew up behind the Iron Curtain in a country whose villages, rivers and mountains within 20 miles or so of the national border were a militarised no-go border zone. This was in fact Europe's southernmost stretch of the Iron Curtain, and it was ostensibly there to protect us, though I saw this later but sensed it even as a child. Its barbs were pointing inwards. The border, a near mythical entity that couldn't be approached, seen, or touched, was a wall as long as the country, electrified and alarmed by Soviet technology in 1961, the same year as the Berlin Wall went up. Hidden by Balkan peaks and impassable forests, the border was out of sight but everywhere, like the state. It was the background hum of the days, the barely perceptible buzz of the nights. It was that which never slept. It was near the Black Sea beaches where we went for holidays, along with the burnt-skinned East Germans, Poles and Czechoslovaks, some of whom went swimming towards Turkey, swimming until they were swept out to their deaths by unexpected currents, or made a run for the forested land border, or on one occasion, went up in an air balloon and crossed into Turkey, like a bird. Like the tens of thousands of storks that darkened our Pontic skies in spring and left for Africa in autumn. It was near the mountain villages where we went to pick berries and climb fir trees, from which you could see Greece, but not visited. The border was in the expression Zad Granica, beyond the border, which simply meant abroad, but had a shivery one-way feel to it, a beyond-the-pale feel. Beyond-the-pale is in fact a colonial phrase, all the way from the 14th century expression coined in Ireland, where it meant any territory that remained beyond English dominion, meaning beyond the pales or stakes, demarcating its outer edges. Which brings to mind the Scottish borders. Back in the day, border reavers collected taxes from travellers, and the Book of Scots law decreed that you couldn't pollute Scottish rivers unless they flowed across the border into England. 4 centuries after the Union of Crowns put an end to the political border, their name has remained, and to this day, the empty roads and denuded hills of the Scottish borders retain an eerie charge, a ghostly desolation. This is the way of borders and margins, They remain haunted for decades, generations, centuries after their somber power has lapsed. Today, the most border-like experience is available on the train from London to Edinburgh. Somewhere before North Berwick, you may hear an announcement that gladdens your heart, or mine at least. Welcome to Scotland. Though I haven't heard it for a few years. Here, the crossing into another realm is an act of the imagination. The very opposite of the first physical border I sighted in 1984. That was the Berlin Wall, complete with soldiers and barricades, asserting the grim finality that the two sides would never meet again. But all hard borders are destined to fall one day. 25 years after the fall of that wall, I travelled back to the border zone of my childhood. It had been demilitarised, but it is still a realm that operates on its own terms, as fairy tales do, and traumatised topographies. I wanted to step across the once forbidden line to make up for lost time. At the Bulgarian-Turkish checkpoint, Europe's busiest land crossing, lorries queued up for miles, waiting to be processed into the European Union. Sometimes it took days, and resigned to wait, drivers set up stoves along the road to brew tea. Some of them carried the kind of cargo that could land them in jail, though not all of them knew what they carried. I saw Bulgarian border police bust a Turkish lorry driver who carried Iraqi Kurdish stowaways. They looked emaciated. He looked close to tears. And the border police looked indifferent, but not immune to bribes. Smuggling has always been brisk on this border, and profitable. In the days of communism, border officials were the wealthiest locals. Today, border police on both sides of the border strike deals with people smugglers so that the already robbed of this world would be robbed again and returned to no man's land. Leaving the derelict communist-era silk factories behind, I drove across the line and a shiny mosque and shopping mall welcomed me to Turkey. My first port of call on the Asian side was the ancient city of Edirne, a distorted mirror image of ancient Svilengrad, Silk Town, on the European side. In Svilengrad, you can almost hear the muezzins of Edirne. In Edirne, you could almost hear the thumping of Svilengrad's casinos. Gambling is banned in Turkey, so Turkish gamblers head to Bulgaria. Family values are compulsory in Turkey, but on weekends, the hotel casinos of Svilengrad heave with trans-border sex tourism. At Edirne's Friday market, you can bag snake oil or fake Levi's for a few euros. This border is hell for the refugee and heaven for the entrepreneur and the corrupt official, the smuggler and the storyteller. A few weeks later, I entered Turkey from Greece at a somnolent small town checkpoint. The Greek guards, apparently struck with some kind of sleeping illness, yawned as they waved me through. But the spell lifted on the Turkish side, which welcomed me with armed soldiers and a customs official who proceeded to gut the contents of my rented car. Later, I was told that the typical drug mule at this border is a woman in a rented car, with a passport to one of the Balkan nations, just like me. The previous week, a Romanian woman had been arrested with a stash of cocaine sewn under the seats. I stood sweating in the sun. Checkpoints feel hot, even in winter, as a busload of Greek tourists looked on. Their bags were being checked too. They were not ordinary tourists, as it happens, but ancestral tourists. Every summer, the children and grandchildren of refugees from the Balkan Wars, 1912 to 1913, World War I, and the Greek-Turkish War, 1919 to 1922, travel to the abandoned houses of their ancestors in the Turkish border villages and towns. The Turks can't travel so easily in Europe, so they sit in their village squares drinking glasses of tea and feeling all the emotions of their Greek and Bulgarian visitors, the loss, the grief, the confusion. because they too are grandchildren of one-time Muslim refugees from Greece and Macedonia, Bulgaria and Bosnia, the people of the former Ottoman Empire, whose borders in Europe were being redrawn by militant Balkan nationalisms and the ruthless games of the great powers. All of this haunts the land, making the stress of border crossing in the Balkans hard to convey, even in broad daylight, with the right passport and nothing to declare. With clammy hands, I drove down a corridor of barbed wire between Greece and Turkey, narrow and one-directional like a birthing canal. It was a living souvenir from the Cold War, when this border was darkened by the armies of three enemy countries, Greece, Turkey, and Bulgaria. A pink flamingo from the border river Evros flew above me like an omen. Though good or bad, I couldn't tell. Borders express our collective anxiety for clarity and certainty, here and there, us and them. But over time, borders flicker like mercury, move like shifting sands beneath our feet, collapse yet haunt the landscape, and are redrawn a generation later in the name of some new fear that isn't new at all. In the meantime, they inflict psychic wounds. Just as my book Border was coming out, I travelled to Southeast Asia and accidentally stumbled across the closest Asian equivalent to my border, the notorious crossing at Poipet, at the Thai-Cambodian border. Infamous Poipet is infamous for much deadlier reasons than tourists realise. Worried as they are about visa scams and impromptu fees demanded by officials in currencies you don't have. About 20 miles from the checkpoint, coming from the Thai side, you experience a tense border kind of feeling. Thai army roadblocks appear at regular intervals along the banners that read country, religion, monarchy, people. This was once the site of the largest refugee camp in Asia, housing 250,000 traumatised Cambodians who had survived the genocidal regime of Pol Pot, but didn't wish to remain in Cambodia. Thailand didn't want them either. Some families of Cambodian refugees who had crossed into Thai territory were turned back at gunpoint by Thai soldiers and forced to march across mined terrain back into Cambodia. Their bones remain there, in these lesser-known killing fields. Once you reach the Thai border town of Aranyaprathet, it becomes clear that a brisk border economy thrives here. The young Finnish couple who shared a taxi with us had blank faces and empty suitcases. They had no intention of going across into Cambodia. They were not interested in Angkor Wat or the legacy of the Khmer Rouge. No, they were here to shop. And the unambiguously named Border Hotel was just across the street from the border shopping mall. Cambodians go across to buy Thai produce at the border market or do seasonal work, and Thais go across to Poipet town to gamble their lives away, sometimes literally. Every year there are murders in the casinos on the Cambodian side, involving the three main gambling nationalities of the region, Chinese, Thai, and Korean. Although Cambodians have recently been banned from gambling, prostitution and sex trafficking remain big business here. If the Thai side is a cheerful purgatory where you run a dusty gauntlet to the checkpoint of stalls selling fried beetles, the Cambodian side is a beautiful inferno. You enter the Kingdom of Cambodia through a massive gate of carved Khmer stone, straight into the arms of the hawkers, who sell you everything you don't need, from contraband cigarettes to massage. A miasmic odour rises from the canal that runs across the border, and where I glimpse shadowy figures scuttling across, Cambodians skipping passport control, and I worried for them. As with the Bulgarian, Turkish and Greek-Turkish border, the Thai-Cambodian border is radioactive with human trauma, but also ultra-porous. as porous as the history of the region and the morality of its power brokers. On the Cambodian side, until only 15 years ago, the road to Siem Reap and Angkor Wat, now driven in 2 hours, was impassable. The border zone was being mined by the Khmer Rouge well into the 1990s. The hills in the more remote border areas are still mined. Here, as in my native borderlands, nightmares come and go in the shape of political regimes and rapacious governments, each replacing the next. But gambling remains a long-standing speciality in the geopolitical game of monopoly. For as long as hard borders are nightmared into being by the ruthless, the fearful, the powerful, the brainwashed, the deadly hopscotch for grown-ups will continue. And with it, the human need to tell the stories of what happens when you step across the line, quickly, terribly light, with just the clothes on your back and your hopes and everything you left behind, trying not to stumble and lose your balance.
A huge thanks to Kapka for being with us, and of course to Leah for her wonderful reading of Kapka's text. Now, in the next episode, I'll be in conversation around the idea of graphic design, of the publication, of course, of books, and thinking about how identities are made creatively when you have the best talents available working with you. And I'll be speaking to Sonia Dykova and Imogen Eveson about their very particular and distinctive contributions to the great enterprise that is the Walking Project. I do hope you can join me for that episode, and thank you indeed very much for being with us for this one. And goodbye.